We talk about healthcare a lot in this country, but it's often in economic and political terms. Case in point, the passage of national health insurance reform 5 years ago and the ongoing debate about the merits of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, if you prefer. Today, we get a more personal take on healthcare at the patient level. Teresa Brown is a nurse who wrote a book about a single day of work in her book, The Shift, One Nurse, 12 Hours, Four Patients' Lives. Teresa Brown has a PhD in English from the University of Chicago and in a past life taught English at Tufts University in Massachusetts. It was after that she turned to nursing, and she now works in a clinical setting in Pennsylvania. Her columns have appeared in the New York Times, CNN.com, and elsewhere. Her earlier book is called Critical Care. Teresa, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So why leave academia and go into a profession that probably has longer shifts along with a few other rigors?
Right. No time for long conversations over coffee. The truth is, I really liked teaching, but I didn't feel passionately about it. And I had kids and discovered this whole new side of me that really liked taking care of people in this very physical, intimate way and juggling all kinds of crazy things. And a friend who's a nurse pointed me toward nursing, and I thought, wow, that's it. That's what I want to be doing. And I love it.
Do you have a particular specialty within nursing?
My background's mostly in oncology, but about a year ago, I switched to doing hospice nursing. So, yeah, the serious side of healthcare and illness.
So not when people can be easily fixed and sent on their way, but a more lingering kind of situation.
Right, exactly. So the book, The Shift, is about my work on a bone marrow transplant floor. So that's with patients who have what we call blood cancers, leukemias, lymphomas, and we do much better with those diseases than we did, say, 30 years ago, but they're still very, very difficult to treat and cure. So those patients often come in for weeks at a time. There's a patient in the shift, Dorothy, who was diagnosed with leukemia and then spent 6 weeks in the hospital getting the chemotherapy she needed, and then we have to wait for her body and her immune system to recover from that. So she has spent 6 weeks in the hospital and is basically just waiting until she's set to go home.
Is she the one you wrote about as having almost no platelets because of her leukemia treatment?
Yeah, that's what would happen at the very nadir of the treatment effect, because chemotherapy kills off quickly growing cells, which includes cancer cells, but then other kinds of cells too. So our bone marrow, which produces our red blood cells, our white blood cells, and our platelets, takes a huge hit. And also our digestive tract, that's why you get a lot of vomiting. And also our hair, that's why people lose their hair.
Oh, fast-growing cells. You have opened up a whole new world of understanding here now.
Oh, good.
But, I didn't even think about it in the terms that you relate it in the book, that people who've been through serious chemotherapy are along the lines of hemophiliacs in their ability to clot blood or not, in fact.
Yes, and the nice thing is that we can transfuse them. So we can give people platelets, and we can give people red blood cells. We can't give people white cells, so we just have to wait for their immune system to come back. The really amazing thing about platelets, though, is that a normal platelet count is something like, 110 to 150,000, something like that. It's really, really large. But with just 10,000 platelets, people are okay.
Wow.
Yeah, if they go below 10, then people can spontaneously bleed. So you worry about bleeding in the brain or internal bleeding. And we'll transfuse them to keep them up above that level. But it's pretty incredible that our bodies are that resilient.
That is amazing, which I guess is one of the keys to chemotherapy, is we figure out the body can take a whole lot of beating and still keep functioning.
Exactly. And the point of a stem cell transplant is that we actually give the body such an intense beating that it can't recover. The patients get really, really intense chemotherapy, and then we give them stem cells, what used to be called bone marrow. We still call it that, but it's really stem cells now, the pluripotent stem cells that are in bone marrow. And we give that back to patients after we've really kind of wipe them out with chemo. So we call it a rescue therapy, which was cool when I figured that out. I thought, oh, that's neat. Wow. Because we're really like doing them in a way, and then we save them.
Well, yeah, there's an element of having to be rescued from the therapy, too, I guess, is the strange twist on words there. But the point is that you're taking them down to almost nothing and then rebuilding them.
Yes, and I'm making it sound like, oh, I just have a big smiley face on it. It is risky. There are people who don't do well. You know, I don't want to make it sound like it's this very easy thing to go through. It's quite serious, and of course, ethically, there are questions, because for some people, the treatment will actually lead to them being sicker in a different way than they were when they had cancer. I mean, the cancer would have killed them, but then effects of the treatment can also kill them, and that can be very hard. So I try to focus on the good that we do, but also be aware that it's tough. This is not like, you know, taking an aspirin when you have a headache. I mean, it's quite serious and can be quite hard on people.
Teresa, does your writing come from a particular viewpoint on the quality or delivery of healthcare?
Well, I think nurses have such a great bird's eye view of what healthcare needs, because we spend so much time with patients. So I would say I try to have my point of view really be the patient's point of view, because that's nurses' entire training. We're taught that we are the patient advocate. We're the one who's really there looking after the patient. So we're trained to try and see healthcare in the hospital through the patient's eyes, except for, of course, situations where our expertise has to step in. So I'm really looking at what's going to make things best for the patient.
Making people feel good is the real goal here. The book is called The Shift, One Nurse, 12 Hours, Four Patients' Lives. Teresa Brown is the nurse, Teresa Brown, RN, also PhD in English. I love that combination. We'll come back and talk more with Teresa Brown about her experiences on the floor in the hospital, and you can join us as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Teresa Brown and you in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today to Teresa Brown, who is a nurse in Pennsylvania who writes pretty well, too, because she's got a PhD in English. She's written a book about one particular day at the hospital where she works. The book is called The Shift, One Nurse, 12 Hours, Four Patients' Lives. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about healthcare from a micro rather than macro perspective. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Teresa, you write that nurses worry about doing too much or too little. How does that affect your decisions on a regular basis?
Well, I try to follow my gut and do what my clinical instincts tell me is the right thing to do. But we can definitely get caught in a catch-22 where if you sound the alarm about something and the physician usually decides it wasn't appropriate, then you end up looking like an alarmist and someone whose clinical judgment can't be trusted. But then if there's something serious going on and you think, well, I don't know, should I sound the alarm on this? And you don't, then you can also get criticized for that. So the problem really comes down to a matter of communication. Sometimes you're going to be worried about a patient and they may be doing better than you think, and they may actually be worse than you think. And nurses should be able to talk that over with the other people on the care team and think, do we need to take more strenuous action here or just sit back and let this resolve itself?
I get the sense of fairly constant movement, though, so I wonder how often you do get a chance to just pause long enough to compare notes with other people who know the case.
Yeah, you do have to carve out time for that. And that's why I picked the day I did to write about in The Shift. The two primary patients, Sheila and Mr. Hampton, were part of an actual shift that I had. So Sheila comes in with this rare blood disorder because we do oncology patients, cancer patients, but also hematology blood disorders. And I thought she was basically fine, needed some tweaks to her medication, but she would be okay. And it turns out she actually had a very, very serious surgical problem. Then Mr. Hampton was a frail elderly man with lymphoma getting a drug called Rituxan that can be very toxic. And I was quite concerned that he wouldn't be able to tolerate it. And his situation turned out differently than I had expected. So that day had a really profound impact on my understanding of healthcare, that we can learn all these things about people from our scans and our tests, but sometimes we're just wrong. And so anytime you have that nagging feeling of something just doesn't seem right here, then you got to take the time to talk to someone else about it. And talking to other nurses about things can be great, because that can be just a great clinical check on, yeah, this is bad, or, you know, I think it's okay, but why don't you call and just let them know what's going on.
By the day of the shift, how long had you been nursing full time?
Probably about 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm. And is it the kind of thing where you feel like after, you know, a year or two that you pretty much got a rhythm to it, or were you still sort of getting established by that time?
Definitely at the end of a year, I felt like, okay, I get this. But by the end of 2 years, I got it much, much better. And it's interesting, in nursing, they'll call you a baby nurse until you've got at least a couple of years under your belt. And I think that's right. It takes that long to get a sense of, well, just how unpredictable the work can be, but also how complicated hospitals are, and how do you, as I say, put your shoulder to the rock that is modern healthcare and push it up the hill. There's all kinds of things that get in the way of doing that, and the more experience you get on the job, the better you get at working around those obstacles.
There's a lovely description of your bike ride to work. Do you ever really know what your day holds coming in?
No, no. And in fact, that's something that we on the floor would talk about at the start. Just, you never know what's going to come up. And there's that moment in the book when I talk about getting my papers, because you get papers for each of your patients. And I say that it's like being dealt a hand in a poker game, because until you pick up the papers or the cards, you don't know what you've got. And it's very rare in work like that that you get a royal flush, right?
Right.
Usually it's much more of a mixed bag.
I got a pair of jacks and a couple of, you know, threes.
Yeah, right. And you just hope there's no joker that got in there.
Wow. You remind us early on, we're talking to Teresa Brown, by the way, her book is The Shift, about working as a nurse in a hospital. You remind us that a shift for a nurse is 12 hours, and as somebody who is pretty much done after 9 or 10, in a much less strenuous profession, I wonder why.
Yeah, it is controversial. There is data that shows mistakes go up after about 10 hours. It started out as a lifestyle choice in some ways, because nurses could work 3 days on, 3 12s, and then have 4 days off. And that is fun, because then you have a lot of time when you're not at work. But the downside is obviously very long days and people get tired. The upside, though, and I hope this comes across in the book, is that we get to watch over these patients basically the whole time that they're awake and there's really active care going on. There are so many balls in the air for every hospital patient. And with just an 8-hour shift, so say I'd start at 7 a.m. and then leave at 3 p.m., there's much more chance of one of those balls getting dropped or kicked away if I have to do what's called a handoff to another nurse. Not that that nurse won't be equally as competent, but there's so many little details that matter, and you can't always get them all across to that other person. And it may be that some little detail that didn't seem important becomes important by 5 in the afternoon, and the person who comes in at 3 isn't going to know that. So you get a person who's fresh, but they won't know the whole story of that patients stay. So I really like that feeling of being able to watch over people for a whole entire day, even though I'm hungry and even though I'm tired.
You mentioned picking up the poker hand. How is the communication worked from shift to shift? I wonder how the nurse who had your four patients before you communicated that information to you about their needs.
Right, and we call this report. And I love that when I first started as a nurse. It was like, do you want report? And I would feel like, what is that? But it's the exchange of information. The way we do it at the hospital that I wrote about was through something called voice care. So the nurse finishing her shift would tape an account of each of the patients in a code under their room number. And then I would come in while that nurse was finishing up the shift and then listen to his tape and write down all that information, then check in with that nurse and say, do you have any updates? Has anything changed?
Before we get to specific cases in any depth, you better explain how you stayed right with patient confidentiality rules and laws.
Right. Well, if you know the rules for HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, it's actually quite easy to not violate those rules because actual protected health information is very specific. Someone's exact name, their address, their exact diagnosis, their social security number, their birthday. You know, it's not hard to leave those things out. In the book, I gave myself a pretty wide latitude to change names, to change physical descriptions of people. And, of course, I'm not going to reveal what I changed about whom. Also giving, say, a looser diagnosis than someone has, just saying a lymphoma rather than they may have a very specific kind of lymphoma that's rare. But hiding that information doesn't affect the overall arc and truth of their story, so I don't have to reveal that. So it's a lot of careful thought. At this point, I'm so used to doing it, I feel like I just have a kind of built-in internal editor that thinks, wait a minute, should you really say that they have curly blonde hair that goes all the way down to their waist? No, because combined with some other things, it might be obvious who that is. So, okay, well, you suddenly became, you know, a redhead with a page boy.
But the lymphoma is what still counts there. Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Teresa Brown is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She's a nurse at a medical facility of indiscriminate description. In the book, The Shift, One Nurse, 12 Hours, Four Patients' Lives. Okay, it's a hospital. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about healthcare at the micro level, how it is done right there between nurse and patient. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Michael in Arcata. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Teresa Brown. Michael, go ahead.
Hello. This is Michael Freck and Dr. Freck. I'm a palliative care doctor, and I'm wondering, is there a role to help families with transitions when things are shifting from we're getting this to it's not going to work and this person's going to have trouble? Is there a role for palliative care teams and support services in parallel in the bone marrow transplant unit or the ICU?
All right. Excellent question. Thanks for that, Dr. Fratkin. So palliative care, which essentially means providing care that makes people feel good but doesn't really necessarily get them better. Is that a fair assessment, Teresa?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know Dr. Fratkin from social media, so it's lovely to hear your voice and know you are a real person. Thanks for calling in. Yeah, definitely palliative care is essential, I would say. And there's data that shows that patients do much better with palliative care, oncology patients who get palliative care along with curative treatment. They have a better quality of life, which isn't surprising, but they also live longer. So that's very, very important. And oncology is slowly getting that. My experience with oncologists is they like to be in charge and really have oversight of all the patient's care, and it's hard sometimes to let another MD come in and say, well, why don't we focus on all the vomiting here, and can we really do something to make that better? And then they work together so that the patient's life isn't just horrible while he's getting treatment.
Let's talk about patient loads for nurses, how they're determined and how heavy they can get.
That is a very, very important question. I picked 4 patients from my book because that was the standard load on our floor. And I had several people say, 4 patients, what's that? You know, they were imagining, say, a waitress in a restaurant where that would be 1 or 2 hours work, right? But then people have read the book and they said, wow, I really see everything that's involved. And 4 patients is definitely enough. That's a day's work. The sad thing is, though, I've had nurses call into other radio programs and say, 4 patients, ha, you know, I would never have 4 patients. I would have 6, I would have 8, I would have 10. And I really want the public to understand that this has been empirically validated. The risks to patients go up the more patients a nurse has. So as a country and a healthcare system, we need to really look at that and say it's very important to not have nurses stretched so far that patients are actually put at risk. And there's data that shows patients will die, who wouldn't otherwise, if nurses are asked to do too much.
And how constant a tug of war is there over patient loads between nurses and hospitals?
It's very constant. Unfortunately, since doctors are able to bill, they're seen as people who bring in money. Nurses don't bill, so we're seen as a cost for the hospital and the biggest labor cost by far for hospitals. So when people in accounting are looking at money, it's easy to say, well, we can save some money by cutting nurses. But that's a mistake for patients. And actually, people are starting to do research to show that that's even a mistake financially because of the number of infections that goes up, the falls that patients have, and how expensive those are to the system. All of a sudden, you've got someone who came in for one thing. They're staying twice as long because they fell and broke a leg. And the problem is that the people who look at the cost of nursing aren't always talking with those other people who are focusing on increased length of stay costs and connecting that with nursing. So those connections need to be made a lot more explicit. And I hope that some administrators read my book and they get a little aha moment and figure it out.
The book is called The Shift. Teresa Brown is its author. You mentioned length of stay. I mean, I've been hearing for about the last 20, 30 years that the people who go to hospitals now generally tend to be sicker and stay longer. Is that still pretty much the case?
Well, yeah, they tend to be sicker, definitely. There's really a push to try and get people out as quickly as possible, in large part because people tend to do better in their homes. So the people who are actually in the hospital need a lot more intense care. The hard part about sending them home is that increasingly we send people home with these very complicated health care needs and expect their families to be able to take care of them with, you know, half an hour of training from a busy nurse in the hospital. And it's really scary for family members. And you know, I decided to do this job. They didn't. So
right.
They may not be at all comfortable with doing my work. And I wasn't when I first started. That's why you go to school and you learn how to do it. So there needs to be more support for those patients when they go home.
When they're in the hospital, though, I mean, you know, you are so important to these people for a little while. But how not get attached to people, or do you get attached to them?
Oh, I get completely attached to them. I had a nurse when I first started who told me, if you stop caring, you need to find a new job. And I just accept that attachment and that sometimes it's going to be very difficult because they're not going to do well as part of the job. It's just part of the job. And it's a hard part, but it's also what makes the job really rich and really rewarding. So in the book, when there's a code and a patient who's not my patient, but someone I've known for a couple of years as a patient is not doing well and ends up having to go to the ICU, And I talk about how it's just incredibly sad when that happens. But the thing to do is to accept that and get into the zen of it. This is what life has handed him, and it's handed me as his caregiver. And so I try to appreciate the good that I have going on.
You mentioned the code. I kept waiting for a code blue or something similar. I guess I spent too many years watching ER and Grey's Anatomy. I mean, is that pretty much TV convention, or do you actually call codes?
No, we do actually call codes. They're called different things. Sometimes they're called conditions. Sometimes they say rapid response team. I've never worked anywhere where someone actually says code blue, but maybe it does happen, not just on TV. But we do actually call codes, and codes can be great, quite literal lifesavers when someone's in a position where they're just not doing well in such an intense way that we know we can't take care of it all by ourselves on the floor. So suddenly their heart rate's going through the roof, or their blood pressure is really dropping, or their breathing suddenly got a lot more labored, or, you know, did they have a stroke? Are they having a seizure? And then you call a code, and you get a doctor from the intensive care unit, and nurses from the intensive care unit, and usually a respiratory therapist and an anesthesiologist. And we do the whole dramatic thing of bringing what's called the crash cart into the room, which basically looks sort of like a John Deere toolbox.
Wow.
But has drawers full of the breathing masks and the drugs we need to help resuscitate people.
Wow, it's a fascinating process. We'll learn a little more about it when we come back from a break. The book is called The Shift, One Nurse, 12 Hours, Four Patients' Lives. Teresa Brown, RN, is the author and our guest. We'll come back and talk more with Teresa. And if you'd like to join us, we'll take your phone calls and emails as well in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Teresa Brown, an RN working at a hospital in Pennsylvania. She was formerly a PhD in English, teaching at Tufts University in Massachusetts, decided to move to a different career. So you can tell her book is well written. It's called The Shift, One Nurse, 12 Hours, Four Patients' Lives. You may join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about healthcare from a micro rather than macro viewpoint for a change. 800-838-3760 around the region, by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. We have an email here from Mike in Medford. He says, my mother recently went through cancer along with radiation and chemo. I should point out you're talking to a medical marijuana state, two medical marijuana states here. he points out a drop of medical marijuana tincture in her tea kept her from almost ever getting nauseous. It helped with her sleep and depression while not being anywhere near as strong as prescribed narcotics. What is the nursing community's view on medical marijuana? Do you see it gaining further acceptance throughout the medical community? That's Mike in Medford.
That is a great question. I would like to see it gain more acceptance, maybe with a little more controls, so that people don't end up taking more than they need, or they get it at a level where it gives them relief and doesn't make them uncomfortable. It's not a drug I personally have a lot of experience with, so I can't really speak to how that might be titrated. But I think there's resistance in the community, the healthcare community, to medical marijuana. I mean, first of all, we don't like something that comes in leaves or, you know, a bag, or we like things in little pills or in
IV bags.
IV bags, right, that we can give to patients and have been distributed by a pharmacy, and we just like to know what we're giving and what's the dose and what's the concentration. So that's part of it. I think there is also a kind of judgment about, you know, people who smoke pot, and you shouldn't do that, and it's just wrong in a way. And the fact that it's been illegal for years, of course, contributes to that impression. So some education on how great it can be, like, that's a wonderful story, saying, look at all the good that was accomplished by medical marijuana. That would really help, because then we could start to look at it as, this is a drug like a pharmaceutical, not a drug like heroin.
Titration, is that referred to how you span out the doses?
Yeah, well, titration is actually a chemistry thing about turning the amount, the number of drops up and down. So I broadened it to say, could we have a sense of, you know, when he said a tincture of marijuana, is that an actual dose or how does that work?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I think people in healthcare would be much more comfortable, you know, and said it's like a roll a joint. Well, what does that mean?
Yeah, six cc's or something.
Yeah, we want something very specific.
Right.
That's what we're comfortable with.
So I would think the general perception about nursing is that the doctors give the orders, but nurses do the work. Is that approximately what happens?
That is approximately what happens, yes. Although in the best systems and the best physicians I know, it's understood that it's a collaborative effort. So it's not just like the doctor saying, do this and do this and do this, and the nurse says, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. but the doctor says, here's what I think we're going to do, and the nurse says, okay, that sounds good. Well, except for that one thing, I don't know, should we really be increasing his blood pressure medication? Here's what happened this morning when he woke up. He almost fell down. He felt so dizzy. And, you know, feedback, right? Because you both are taking care of the same person. So legally, the doctor bears the authority for giving the orders. But legally, the nurse also bears responsibility for carrying them out. And it needs to be much better understood by both of us that that's a collaborative relationship.
I was impressed by your stories of how much research that nurses will do themselves, you know, sitting down at computers and looking up stuff on the web. I was also less than impressed with the fact that the hospital apparently filters the web.
Yes, and that would go off and on. So one day we'd go in and we'd be able to look up a chemotherapy drug, and then the next day we wouldn't. And I sent really angry emails, which were probably impolitic and, you know, stupid, but just saying... We're professionals. How can you treat us like children? This is part of our job. It just made me so incredibly angry. And nurses would also find ways to get around it. So there was a way if you pulled up an EKG online in a certain way, then you could get to Google. You could circumvent the checks, but then they figured that out. Basically, they closed all of our back doors. So there we were, just stuck not being able to look up stuff relevant to these very toxic, difficult drugs that we're giving to patients.
The internet obviously works in the other direction too, though. I mean, when you have access to it, and in this age of WebMD, I wonder how often you have patients say, well, you know, what about the so-and-so, or did you try this, or, you know, you want to try a different dose of that, or anything, you know, you get that fairly often?
Yeah, we do get that, and I try to look at that the most positive way possible, as this is someone participating in their care. Just like the patient in the book, Candace, who is what we in healthcare call a difficult patient, because she has very strong opinions and is not shy at all about asking for what she wants. And I wanted to show that, yes, she's difficult, but there's reasons why she's acting that way. And she is what we would call the empowered patient. She's speaking up for herself. So I think people coming in with questions is great, and the problem is that we're not always good at being able to say, you know, I don't know about that, but really that's not the right approach in this situation, and here's why, or, you know what, let me think about that. It comes across as a kind of challenge, or the patient's telling me that they know how to do my job better than I do. That's not what it is. It's people who are scared, trying to get some control and a sense of understanding. And it also speaks to our failure at times to really communicate with people about what their treatment is going to consist of.
And it's best when they really understand it.
Yeah.
Where you're coming from. Yeah. Let's take another call. Here's Christos in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Teresa Brown, the author of The Shift.
Hi. I just was curious about Teresa's education. How many hours of your training included information on nutrition and its ability to heal?
Oh, good question. Thanks for that, Christos.
Yeah, that is a good question. We did have a required nutrition class. Not a tremendous amount of focus on food being able to heal people beyond the importance of eating well, standard stuff about fruits and vegetables and not too much red meat. again, I think people in healthcare are suspicious of the idea of, well, if you eat almonds every day, then you won't get cancer because we can't measure it, and we want a result like that to be reproducible in a very concrete and controlled way. So there's probably more work there that needs to be done. It could be an area of growth for us.
Is there much coordination in the sense of, you know, I mean, the you have to indicate some dietary restrictions and things to the folks who deliver the food, which is not part of the nursing staff, right?
Right. That's true. And for our immune-suppressed patients, we put them on what we call a neutropenic diet, which means because they have no immune system, they're not allowed to eat salads, they're not allowed to have fresh fruits and vegetables. We ask them to not go to restaurants. There's a whole list of things that we ask them not to have because, say, you get a salad and the person making it didn't wash their hands that well, there might be dirt on it that any of the rest of us with an intact immune system, it wouldn't bother us at all, but someone like them who's completely immune suppressed can make them very, very sick. That diet is controversial. That's, again, there's arguments about whether it really makes a difference, and the hard thing is that it makes patients very, very anxious about everything they eat, and that anxiety is not good for them. So, again, there probably needs to be a really large controlled study where you say, well, does the neutropenic diet make a difference, or is all the anxiety it creates actually leading to other kinds of problems because it's increasing stress levels, and then that has physiological results.
Wow, so much to consider.
Exactly, yeah.
Another call here from Susan in Mendocino. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Teresa Brown.
Hi, thanks so much for this conversation. I was a RN for long enough, and I did want to thank you for pointing out the situation around nurses more than occasionally feeling a lack of support from their own system, their own structure, i.e., hospitals, et cetera, but at the same time having to burden quite the responsibility load and that it comes, it gets taken out in their own health. At one point, I was charge nurse of a NICU, and I called for a meeting just for venting. Everyone was unhappy, and it was strenuous, and we got the head site guy on that campus, and you know, of course, I went through the head nurse, blah blah blah. But it was very timely and important. And I wanted to ask you about how much strain, illness wise, you write about or talk about or see with coworkers from that amount of stress. And I'll take my answer off the air, and thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Susan. Appreciate it.
Oh, that was a really great example. I can say that situations like that happen a lot, and more what we're hearing is that we have to do more with less. And that sounds okay, but after a while, doing more with less just means you get less, too. There's only so much more you can get out of less. In terms of health issues, I mean, definitely there's a fair amount of overweight among nurses, and I attribute at least some of that to the poor eating habits we have at work, the getting really, really hungry at work and getting really stressed out. There's a lot of injuries. I think everyone knows at least one nurse personally who's had to leave the job because of a back injury, and it's just, oh, she had a back injury. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I remember reading and hearing about how difficult it is to lift patients. And I mean, it's just totally unergonomic, and there's no good way to do it.
Yes. NPR actually just had a really great series about a couple of months ago about on-the-job injuries and how more nurses, a larger percentage of nurses, get injured on the job than I think any other profession. And when you think that includes construction workers, it's really, really sobering. So there are a lot of stress issues and burnout and, you know, people who love the job but are so frustrated with just being stretched so thin every single day, and we need more support. She said it exactly correctly.
I'm always struck by the different ends of the human spectrum, though. I mean, you're caring individuals. You have to, get a feel for what people need. But at the same time, you also have to thrust needles into them. And I wonder how long it takes to get used to that part of the job.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Yeah, I'm not someone who got into healthcare because I really looked forward to the idea of, sticking tubes in people or... So I really had to get used to that, the idea of hurting people, even with a very small needle can hurt. And I just try to be as careful as possible. And it's always a compliment when someone says, oh, you're good, I didn't feel that at all. But then, there might be the next person and getting their IV in really makes them want to scream and jump out of their skin. So I try to be really conscious of the fact that I'm hurting them, and I know I'm doing it for a good reason, but I need to be as gentle as I can be.
So how long do you think you'll do this? I mean, is there another career in the offing? I mean, you did get up to PhD in English and teach English at Tufts and all that, but then decided that wasn't what you wanted to do. It sounds like nursing is a love affair. Is this a lifelong love affair?
Oh, I think so, yeah. A year ago, switched to home care because after being in the hospital and writing a book about people in the hospital, I felt like we could really do better in the hospital in terms of giving people dignity and a sense of respect and privacy. And so I thought, well, I'm going to do home care and see what the differences are, and then I can really learn something. So that's been incredibly rewarding. I love the hospital. I think the hospital is so important, but this outside view has been great because I see people feel better about themselves in their home, but then they may have symptoms that we can't manage very easily, like pain or vomiting, and they want to stay in their home. So then it's how do you balance that out? How do you bring the good of the hospital to the home, and how do you bring the good of the home to the hospital?
Okay, is there a book at work on that one, too?
Sounds like it, doesn't it?
It really does. It does. Well, this one was certainly enjoyable to read. The Shift, One Nurse, 12 Hours, Four Patients' Lives. Teresa Brown, RN, wrote it and joined us on The Exchange. Teresa, thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye. And that'll do it for today's Exchange. You can find out more about the program at our website, jeffexchange.org. Follow us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter, at Jeff Exchange. The Exchange is produced by Emily Curitan, who's writing the controls today as well. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Join us next time on the Jefferson Exchange, and have a great day.